We're now in the guts of the class formation section. It's a short little sort of bridging block in the course where we're going to discuss what I think of as an extremely interesting and provocative set of analyses by Klaus Offa and Helmut Wiesenthal. I think of this work as Offa's work. Klaus, who is an old friend of mine at this point, insists that this particular paper always be referred to as Offa and Wiesenthal, which is good, you know. I mean, Wiesenthal was a student of his, and they did collaboratively write this paper. But this paper has a lot of continuity with a lot of other things that Offa has written. Klaus Offa is a student of Habermas. He's a few years older than I am. I think he's early 70s at this point. He came here last year as a Haven Center visitor. When I was a second-year graduate student at Berkeley, he was there as a visiting professor for a semester, and I took a course from him at the time when he was working on all this stuff. And you're going to read a series of things by him. This was when he was actually producing them. And they were just, for me, fantastic courses. Probably the most important courses I took as a graduate student. And I wrote so this is a personal anecdote. I wrote a term paper for him in that class that I took from him, which was subsequently published. And it was a comparison of Lenin's State and Revolution and Max Weber's not very frequently read but really interesting paper on parliamentary institutions in Germany towards the end of World War I. He wrote a kind of political essay on how the German state should be reconfigured after the war. It turned out that Lenin was writing the State and Social Revolution, States and Revolution, and Weber was writing that essay on parliamentary democracy in a reconstructed Germany. They were writing it exactly at the same time. They were literally, because they were in the same time zone, so to speak, they were undoubtedly, there were moments when they were literally at their respective desks writing these things. So it was and they were both writing it in situations of high indeterminacy. Lenin was writing on the eve of the Russian Revolution, projecting what he thought the revolutionary state should be like. Weber was writing on the eve of the end of World War I and the Kaiser regime about what democracy should be like. So it was a great context for writing a comparison of the two papers. And it's, you know, it's a good paper, and Klaus liked it. But he said something in his comments to me, which, you know, really surprised me, flattered me, but surprised me. He said, "Eric, it's a really interesting paper filled with ideas, but don't waste your time writing about other people's ideas. Your ideas are interesting enough. Write about them." Whoa, you know, that was, I was young, I was 24 at the time. 25, I guess. Was beginning my own theoretical work, beginning to write things that were developing my own ideas. And to get that message, that's really the point of scholarly work, is to develop new ideas, and not simply in the form of compare and contrast, right? So as students, you get endless exercises, sometimes on exams, on prelims. For those of you who are graduate students, you'll certainly have questions of this sort. In lots of term papers, where you're said, here are great thinkers, compare and contrast their views on X, right? And we get into a habit of thinking that that's what scholarly work is. And there is a certain tradition of very erudite scholarly work that takes exactly that form. And sometimes it produces very interesting work, but often it's very interesting work that's encumbered by a huge amount of spade work that kind of gets in the way. So there's a terrific book by Andrew Arado and Gene Cohn on civil society. I forget exactly what the title is. It might be Civil Society. An excellent book, one of the definitive contemporary statements. But it's 800 pages long, and you have to wade through endless discussions of what Hegel said, and Schmegel said, and Habermas and Parsons, and just endless discussions about what everybody else said and why they were incomplete or what's good about them and all this stuff. And I just kept wanting to say, okay, now just tell me what the bottom line is. What's the right way to think about civil society? You know, why not spend 3 pages locating yours within this long, and then just really give me a careful. And there is no careful, clear, transparent discussion of their views. You can figure it out. It's there. I mean, and it's interesting, unquestionably. It's very fine scholarship. I'm criticizing it only from the vantage point of my particular way of now thinking about how you do theory. A lot of courses that are called sociological theory courses are really sociological theorist courses. They're really courses about the ideas of particular theorists, and they get organized that way. You do Marx for a bunch of time, then you do Weber, then you do Durkheim, then you do Bourdieu, or whatever the sequence might be. They're works on bodies of theoretical work, they're courses on bodies of theoretical work, rather than around the ideas as such, and their logics and their interconnections. Now, of course, you have to have sources. I'm not saying that you don't have to grapple with those. And it's totally appropriate as a student to thoroughly read the best theoretical work that's there and criticize it. But really, to the extent that you can, even if you don't have, ambitions to be grand theorists, of course, that's not everybody's skill, that's not everybody's way of engaging ideas, is to try to invent wholly new ways of thinking about things. Still, you're stand towards these things should be to appropriate the best ideas and build frameworks, which can be modifications of an existing framework. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to have, again, ruptural breakthroughs. But you need to appropriate them for your purposes. That should be the way to think about it. Well, Klaus gave me this fantastic bit of advice, probably the single best piece of advice I got as a graduate student. And so I feel terrifically indebted to him. We have had a very warm relationship over the years, including his visit here last academic year as a Haven Center visitor. So this is one of his key pieces that he wrote in the, '74, '75, I forget when it was published originally, on two logics of collective action. And that's why I think, that's the piece of work I want to focus on in today's lecture. His analysis is really useful and important, not because it's an accurate account of the actual dilemmas that every working class organization faces, or in the concluding section where he has this wonderfully evocative account of the historical logic of development, contradiction, dissolution, and reconstruction of working class organizations. It's very neat, and the world is way, way messier than that. There isn't this character of cumulative organizational deepening over time through these cycles of opportunism and militancy. So there's a lot of ways that you can pick holes in this argument. But the way of thinking it represents, how it tries to decompose the problem for different class categories, the way it sees the collective action problem as having distinctive properties for different categories of actors, all of those elements I think are really excellent. And the thinking in it is very sound. But it needs to be modified for particular contexts and perhaps set aside and reconstructed in a different way in some. But I want to focus on some of its details here because I think it's very productive to do so. So first, let me just remind you of what the whole big point is here. I'm going to sort of set the terrain again. The first part of the class, we were looking at what I will use a spatial metaphor here. What can be thought of as the vertical relations in society that constitute the structures in which people live their lives. We mostly focused on class relations, relations of domination and exploitation within the organization of economic activities within which people live their lives. We briefly talked about gender relations, another vertical structure of relations that structure the way people live their lives in families, especially, but not only. And race relations, the way people live their lives in communities, but not only, you know, structured around hierarchically organized relations of domination and exclusion around race. Broadly speaking, these hierarchical relations determine conflicts of interest. One of the claims of the Marxist tradition, which it shares to a greater or lesser extent with feminists and critical race theorists, is that the vertical relations in which we lives structure people's interests. And it structures them in a way that has at least a certain objective face to it. That is, people can be wrong about them. It's not just that you have whatever interests you think you have, you can be mistaken about what your interests are as they are structured by these vertical relations. Just again to repeat a point, because it's a constant point of confusion, to say that interests are objective does not mean that you necessarily should give them priority. That is, the weight you give those interests is not objective. So if you have interests as a member of an ethnic community and interests as a member of a class, and you feel that your ethnic solidarity with your local ethnic entrepreneurs and capitalists is more important to you, that protecting your ethnic heritage is a more important thing than advancing your own material interests, and you form solidarities with elites within your ethnic group, that's not false consciousness. There's nothing objective about the one way or the other, about the weight you give interests that are formed by your ethnicity versus interests that are created by your class. What's objective is that in forming that solidarity with the capitalist of your ethnic group, you are trading them off against your interests as a member of the working class. That's objectively true. That's a fact about the world in which you live, that you are sacrificing material interests for purposes of ethnic solidarity. If you then believe that you're not doing that, if you believe that actually your solidarity with the ethnic capitalists is what is going to advance your material interests, and what it does is just makes you more accepting of the sweatshop condition. That's a false belief. So the issue of false consciousness, of objective interests, has to do with how you understand the trade-offs that exist in the world by virtue of the fact that you have multiple interests that often conflict with each other. But false consciousness is not about the weights you give them. Sometimes people make the additional claim that having ethnic solidarity at the expense of class interests shows that you have false identities. I think that's the kind of elitist, I know it all and you're an idiot kind of view that really is not justified. You know, you're not justified in claiming that one identity is more important for the actual life of a person than another. You are justified in saying, okay, if you're going to pick that identity, if that's the one that's going to override others, here are the costs to you. And if a person says, no, that's not true, well, then you can have a debate about the objective conditions of lives. Is that point clear? Because that really, for those of you who are activists and stuff, that issue comes up all the time. And there's a lot of confusion. You know, people think that as an analyst, to talk to people in any way about them having incorrect ideas, false ideas, is a kind of elitist, arrogant thing to do. And it is sometimes, and it isn't others, and it depends upon the precision. That's why, you know, really the devil is in the details here. It really depends upon the precise way in which these questions are framed. Okay, so back to basics. Well, the first part of the course was about all these vertical relations and how they structure the interests of people. We're now shifting to what I think can be called, again using a loose spatial metaphor, horizontal relations. The horizontal relations are the relations by which people come to cooperate with each other to defend and advance the interests that are determined and shaped by the vertical relations. In a sense, then, at least in a logical sense, we can talk about whether this is actually a sequencing argument. It's at least a logical, there's a certain logical sense. The vertical relations are prior to the horizontal ones. They have a logical priority. You form relations of solidarity to defend interests which are already given by the structure in which you're living your life. Often this also has a sequential sense, that is, the horizontal relations don't even form until those vertical relations have been in place for a while. Now, sometimes the strict historical sequence is more complicated than that, because sometimes people have prior horizontal relations of solidarity, for example, in a community, in which the community then as a whole gets transformed and inserted into vertical relations, in which they already have these horizontal relations before they enter the vertical relations, so to speak. That's a more complicated kind of story when that happens. I think it's an interesting thing. But it doesn't disrupt the logic, I think, of the fact that class formations are the formations of collective associations among people to advance and defend their interests, where those interests are defined by the vertical relations in which people live their lives. In the class context, it's the vertical relations within production and the economy. Another little terminological note, this has been implicit in what's been said so far, but it's worth making it explicit. The expression social relations of production is sometimes interpreted as meaning social relations at the point of production, that is, inside the production process. That's really not quite right. The social relations of production really means the social relations through which economic activities are organized and controlled. And it really includes exchange as well as production. It's meant to be the encompassing term for describing how access to assets are organized and controlled and how social relations occur for their deployment to produce the goods and services of the economy. But in a market society, that includes how the assets come together, which is through labor markets in the case of workers. So the expression social relations of production should be distinguished from the social relations in production. The social relations in production are the relations that occur in the labor process, in the actual settings of work. The social relations of productions refer to the encompassing set of relations within which all of these activities occur. All right, so those, now to get us into today's discussion, what we're worrying about here is how do social relations of horizontal solidarities get formed? Last time we discussed some very abstract issues connected to this by posing this idea that game theory provides some very useful tools for setting the stage for this problem because of the ways in which cooperative collective action by any group faces a series of problems. They face problems of that can be broadly described as problems generated by the fact that human beings are not robots, that we are agents capable of making choices, and our decision to participate in a collective action with other people always has to be explained. One explanation is we are just scripted to do so. That's a pretty unsatisfactory explanation. Another explanation is that we do so just because it's in our rational interests. It's purely an intentional explanation. That can be appropriate, but it seems usually to be incomplete, and that's because our decision depends upon other people's decisions. And that's where you get the game theory. Strategic action in a world where we know other people are also engaged in strategic action. Now, that was all framed in terms of particularly this contrast between the free rider problem and the assurance game, conditional altruism, I mean, all that stuff, as a way of understanding what constitutes the achievement of solidarity. And I said, in the formation of horizontal relations of cooperation for collective purposes, the achievement of solidarity is a transformation of the game people are playing when they're making these strategic choices from a prisoner's dilemma into an assurance game. That transformation of one game into another is the process of formation of solidarity. I mean, at least that's how I would describe what solidarity is. And in order to stabilize that accomplishment, that transition from everybody's in it for themselves and they're saying, how can I get the most out of this interaction, and maybe defection is the best, that's the free rider way of assessing the strategies of yourself and others, to I really want to cooperate, we're in this boat together, I care about everybody else, how can I be assured that other people are sharing those views? That's the assurance game. That transition is endogenous to the process of struggle. That's the key idea behind the view that people are transformed by the struggles in which they engage in ways that can either build or destroy collective association. It depends upon what happens. Okay, that was the discussion of last week. Now this week, what we're going to be entering is a more complicated domain using these ideas. And here the question is, well, class formation is actually not just the formation of working class solidarities, it's the formation of capitalist class collective action. One is sometimes, I'm pretty hesitant to say capitalist class solidarities. Capitalists tend to be pretty instrumental about their participation in collective organization. But one might still say that there's at least some elements of real solidarity within elites, class loyalty, class hatreds, class identities that forge some sense of obligation to participate. So that even if capitalists don't particularly feel warm and fuzzy feelings towards fellow capitalists in which they really care about their welfare, you know, maybe in some settings, but mostly it's not so much the conditional altruism in that sense. One can imagine them feeling obligation to contribute to the stability of the class and the security of its interests. They could feel obligations for the same moral reasons that workers feel obligations. That is, they feel the Kantian imperative. I want to defeat these working class struggles, they will destroy the stability of capitalism, they'll undermine the welfare of my enterprises and others. I want to oppose that, well, I have to do my bit. So capitalists can still feel the same, they can feel solidarity in that more limited sense of the moral component, but not the conditional altruist component, would be my expectations. Worker solidarity, I think, contains both. It has both the, as we discussed last time, it has both the notion of genuine reciprocities. My welfare depends upon your well-being because I'll be unhappy if you're suffering. And I feel an obligation to participate in the struggle because I want the struggle to succeed and I'm a moral person. So there's both the moral element and the welfare, interdependent welfare element for workers. Now, the key insight of the Offey and Wiesenthal paper is that workers and capitalists face very different kinds of strategic spaces in deciding how strongly to commit themselves to collective action. They face different dilemmas of collective action. And that's why the paper is called Two Logics of Collective Action. I'm going to mostly focus on the working class here. But the counterpoint to the capitalist class is partially what helps reveal the specificity of the working class dilemmas. All right, so let's begin by stating what the problem is. What can be considered the overall problem of the paper, in a way, and this is also a problem that we'll be discussing in the next lecture when we look at Adam Szaworski's work. The overall problem is this, that Marxists traditionally distinguished two ideal types of class struggle. So this is using very conventional classical language. They distinguish broadly revolutionary class struggle, where the struggle is over what game should be played, and reformist class struggle, which are struggles over the rules within a given game. So to speak, revolutionary class struggle is struggle over the question, should we be playing the game of capitalism or socialism, so to speak? What game should we play? Whereas reformist class struggle is struggle within capitalism over what should be the rules of the game. There's a very nice essay by Roger Friedland and Bob Alford, which we'll be reading in the politics section, which argues that there's actually three kinds of struggle. They add a third one. They draw the distinction using American language between liberal and conservative struggles, liberal versus conservative, reformist versus reactionary, and revolutionary versus counter-revolutionary. And the contrast is revolutionary versus counter-revolutionary is over what game we should play, reformist versus reactionary is over what should be the rules of the game, and liberal versus conservative is struggles over moves in the game. That is, moves given a fixed set of rules. So if you're having a struggle over what the tax rate should be and what the eligibility criteria for food stamps should be, those are liberal versus conservative struggles. Given the rules of the game in politics and the rules of the game in public policy, you then struggle over wage rates if you're a union member, tax rates if you're a politician, and that's liberal versus conservative. Whereas struggles over creating a new healthcare system are reformist versus reactionary. They're concerned with how do we change the rules of the game by which people get access to healthcare. And that's the kind of half-baked, confused reform, but nevertheless reform. I mean, the Obama reforms are genuine reforms. They're changing the ways in which the system is organized, but within capitalist rules of the game. But it's a change of the rules. Whereas struggles over the nature of the system itself, over the kind of game we're playing altogether, would be revolutionary versus counter-revolutionary. That's a tripartite distinction that we'll get to in our discussion of politics in a couple of weeks. So Marxist theory has this usual contrast between revolution and reform. Given the theory of class relations in capitalism, and its basically binary polarized character between workers and capitalists, it's a perpetual puzzle for Marxists, for which answers have to be found, why it is so rare that working class formations ever adopt the ideal type of a revolutionary class formation. Indeed, it's not only rare, one can reasonably say that in developed capitalist countries, there has never been a revolutionary working class. It's not just rare, it's an empty set. There has never been, in a developed capitalist country, a working class that actually was organized around the struggle over capitalism. Doesn't mean there aren't small parties that announce that that's their purposes. They've just never been able to play a significant role in the class formation of popular classes. So how can the theoretical claim of antagonistic class relations be reconciled with the pervasive empirical fact that class struggles are overwhelmingly take the form of accepting the basic rules of the game, or at least accepting the game and then just struggling over what the details of the rules should be? This doesn't mean, of course, that all reformisms are identical. There are reformisms that make pretty significant changes in the rules of the game, although preserving the game, but pretty significant changes. This, in the heyday of social democracy, the nature of that particular variant of capitalism was very different from American capitalism, and different in ways that really mattered for the lives of people. So reformism can accomplish a lot. It's not, this isn't saying it's empty. But it is saying that there was no time in which the Swedish working class was calling into question, in its collective organizations and struggle, the very existence of capitalism. It's just never been on the agenda. How can we get rid of capitalism as a central organizing principle of what, how it thought about its struggles? So that's the puzzle. How do we explain it? We are going to, this week and next, explore two different faces of answers to that. Next week, in Adam Szaworski's theory of class compromise, we'll explore one answer to the question, why is reformism the universal attribute of working class struggles? And his answer is that the dynamic of struggle between workers and capitalists opens up a space where class compromise is possible, and which helps to stabilize capitalism in ways that are better for workers. So his theory of class compromise between classes is what we'll explore on Thursday. Here we're going to look at a different kind of answer. Offie and Wiesenthal's answer to this question is that it's the intra-organizational dilemmas of working class formation that explain the tendency towards reformism. I think you need both of these. I don't think Offie and Wiesenthal's analysis by itself would explain the pervasiveness of reformism as the most advanced ways that working class struggles are organized, but it's part of the puzzle. So Offie and Wiesenthal look at the dilemmas interior to class formation, intra-organizational dilemmas, and Szaworski's looks at the dilemmas that are generated by the interactions between class formations, working class formations and capitalist class formations. Both Szaworski and Offie and Wiesenthal reject two common explanations of reformism on the left, what can be called misleadership and false consciousness. So these are very common explanations that one sees among leftist activists. Misleadership blames reformism on the corrupt and misguided leadership of organizations. Leaders are accused of being sellouts, sometimes of being corrupt, or at best misguided. The misleadership of labor is a phrase that came out of sort of classic left critiques of the labor movement. The absence of revolutionary struggles then reflects a failure of leadership of the working class. What is sometimes called vanguardism often takes as its central point of critique of existing class formations that kind of misleadership. That's misleadership. We will be dedicated to true leadership, we'll be the vanguard, because we have good motives, we're not corrupt, and we have true consciousness, not false consciousness. False consciousness then being the second explanation, that the reason why we only have reformism is because workers suffer from false consciousness. They're victims of ideological indoctrination from above, deception by the bourgeoisie through the media, propaganda, anti-communism, etc. In the absence of ideological manipulation, the argument goes workers would be revolutionary. So these are two classic explanations, misleadership of labor and false consciousness, false beliefs that workers have. Both Offie and Wiesenthal and Szaworski reject these kinds of explanations, which can be called subjectivist explanations, failures of motive and failures of beliefs. They both reject them. Now, to reject them doesn't mean that it never happens. It never means that there are never corrupt leaders. Surely there are. And certainly, one can argue that workers often have false beliefs about the world. Both of these things play a role, but they're not the central mechanisms, according to both Offie and Wiesenthal and Szaworski. And therefore, the solution to the problems are not to somehow figure out how to end the duplicity of leaders, or simply how to protect workers from ideological deception. They, in different ways, identify the central mechanism that explains reformism in the dilemmas of collective action imposed on the working class by the logic of capitalism. By virtue of operating in a mature capitalist society, collective associations face dilemmas that are unavoidable. People make history, but not according to their own choices. These are unavoidable dilemmas. And these dilemmas generate the strong tendencies towards reformist types of class formations. Offie and Wiesenthal look at the way these dilemmas affect the internal associational practices of organizations. And what the term they use to describe this is the associational practices of opportunism. They use the term opportunism to describe this organizational process that is connected to reformism. Shavorsky analyzed these dilemmas in terms of the effects on the struggle between workers and capitalists. But they share this overarching basic mechanism, which says that these constraints and dilemmas imposed on rational, strategically acting workers with clear heads pressures them towards reformism. And that's the kind of foundation of the explanation of reformism, which then gets reinforced by ideological processes, but not generated in the first instance by ideological processes. This is the particular way then of seeing the role of ideology. Ideology stabilizes a structure, normalizes a structure of practices that are themselves being continually fueled and supported by these real objective dilemmas that people face because of the material conditions of struggle, the actual on-the-ground real relations in which people act. That's a pretty powerful kind of argument. And it's not uncontroversial. And it may be wrong. You know, it's a claim about how to put the pieces together between different kinds of causal processes that inform this universal tendency towards reformism. It has, I think, a certain kind of intellectual there's a certain intellectual satisfaction from it. When you really think about these things, it would be more remarkable if ideological indoctrination and misleadership of labor was a universal phenomenon that occurs everywhere sufficiently to produce this universal phenomena, and easier to understand how the universality of these tendencies occurs because of the universality of capitalism, that capitalism as a structure of relations is generating these tendencies, and that the ideological processes then serve to reinforce and smooth things out, rather than that being the driver of it. But again, this should be thought of as a theoretical argument. It is probably impossible to ask, well, what kind of evidence would definitively establish this argument from a counter-argument that ideology drives it? You know, probably there's no clear, unambiguous, empirical way to really nail this down. That's why social science always has endless debates over the same topics. Let me then define opportunism as Offie and Wiesenthal do. Let me give you then a more formal definition of how they approach this. Opportunism has three primary characteristics. First, it involves an inversion of means over ends, in which the maintenance of the organization has higher priority than the pursuit of the goals of the organization. So one symptom of opportunism is when a union is more concerned about maintaining the integrity of the organization than it is in pursuing the goals. Now, that's always done under the argument, which is correct, not false. That's why this is an objective set of dilemmas. That if the organization collapses, it won't be able to pursue the goals anyway. So you have to give priority to strengthening the organization over the pursuit of goals. So while means are only valuable because they are means to an end, in practice, you struggle over protecting the means rather than primarily over achieving the goals. Well, that's the symptom of opportunism. When you lose, you know, you lose the ability to subordinate means to ends, and means themselves become an end. This then is bound up with the second element of opportunism, a preoccupation with short-term gains and losses rather than long-term possibilities. This is a chronic problem in the American labor movement. The question of what should the labor movement do now to ensure greater capacity for struggle 10 years from now is given way less weight than what should the union do now to protect the interests of its members now, very short term. And then this is kind of a just another way perhaps of saying short term over long term, a primacy of tactics over strategy. Indeed, in many cases, almost an incapability of thinking about strategy, only thinking about tactics. So that's what opportunism is. What Offie and Wiesenthal set themselves out to do is explain why is it that working class associations always and everywhere have tendencies towards opportunism. The theory which they end up with, which is this very nice and provocative theory, but with lots of problems with it, is that there's actually an internal dynamic inside of associations that cycles between opportunism and militancy. Militancy being the reverse. The ends are always clearly in sight, and you adopt your strategies to accomplish them. You have a long-term rather than a short-term vision, and strategy has priority over tactics. And so there's this kind of cycling between the two in their view. They develop this argument through, I think, three distinctive kinds of discussions. The first is what could be called the structural logic of opportunism. In that argument, opportunism is an organizational response to the structural logic of collective action faced by workers. So there's this logic of collective action that workers distinctively face. That logic of collective action can be thought called a structural logic. And opportunism is a response to that structural logic. That's the first kind of reasoning. The second reasoning can be called a dynamic logic. Here's where they argue that opportunism is a self-limiting phenomenon. It erodes the condition for its own rationality, and therefore there's a tendency for cycling between opportunism and militancy. I mean, the simple stripped-down form of the argument is that opportunism in the end makes organizations vulnerable to attack and disintegration, that opportunism isn't self-reproducing, it's self-limiting. And when opportunism becomes too pervasive, then at some point it gets attacked and its foundations erode, and that creates openings for new forms of militancy. And then there's an historical logic, and this is this super optimistic early 1970s view of the contradictions of capitalism, which the 1980s disabused us of, and on to the present. And this was that there's a kind of historical learning process across cycles, so that each cycle occurs at a higher level of potential mobilization. So it's not just an endless cycle like this, it's an endless cycle like this. That is, each cycle, militants enter the new cycle of mobilization with historical memory of what happened in the previous cycle, and therefore with greater self-consciousness about what you have to do to ratchet up the capacity for struggle. That's the optimistic view, that the historical trajectory has a tendency to spiral rather than simple circular cycling. Okay. That's stating the problem, which, looking at the clock, suggests an additional problem, which is that in this leisurely exposition of background conditions and overarching themes. At this rate, we'll not come close to going through the entire outline. I guess maybe this is, every once in a while there are lectures in which it makes more sense to relax a little bit about trying to finish everything efficiently and then have discussion. I think what we should do is have discussion as we go. So giving everybody permission to ask questions as we go. And I think this material is dense enough and complicated enough that it is worth my walking us through the steps of the argument rather than saying, well, just read it, now let's talk about it. Okay? So first of all, we could take a little pause here for questions about this first part, but then from here on out in this lecture, you can ask questions as we go. Somebody, yeah, yeah. Tamara.
So how have theorists dealt with the fact that reformism is, quote, universal form of working class politics in developed capitalism, but that it hasn't been in underdeveloped countries? Like, how did Marxists respond to that?
Right. So the key difference in underdeveloped world is the difficulty of creating class compromises. So the Shavorsky story will tell us why, if you can't get even a minimal class compromise, if whenever you get them, they collapse, or when you get them, they affect only a very small segment of the popular classes. Venezuela is a good case. There was a class compromise in the oil sector, unquestionably. The oil sector in Venezuela, which was the heart of the most capitalistic part of that economy, had a very strong compromise between organized labor and global capital. The very privileged workers relative to the rest of the economy, and pretty privileged even not just relative to the rest of the economy. They had stable jobs, they had pretty good incomes, cost of living was historically modest. The class compromise had such powerful exclusionary character with respect to the large majority of the working class and marginalized population that there was still a social foundation for a non-compromise class mobilization. Although one that's proven extremely difficult to actually sustain an anti-capitalist stand. And when we get to Shavorsky's work on the state, not his work on class compromise itself, but on the state, we'll discuss some of the obstacles to actually taking a revolutionary stance interior to the state and sustaining it so long as you're in a capitalist world. But I think that would be the major contrast between developed capitalism and less developed contexts. And it's why in the 19th century there were moments when working classes, even in the European context, appeared to have more of a revolutionary impulse behind them. Class compromises were tougher to really take root. It's also one of the reasons why capitalist democracies have proven such an effective mechanisms of social order, because one way of thinking about what does a capitalist democracy do for capitalism is it makes it easier to forge system-level class compromises in spite of the stupidity of capitalists. Which is, I think, one way of thinking about it, is that capitalists are just as guilty of short-termism as our workers. They can't see their nose in front of their face. They act in ways that are very subversive of the stability of the system as a whole because of their pursuit of profits and viability of their own particular niches and firms. And what capitalist democracy does is makes it easier to discipline capital for system stability, which is essentially, in a very general sense, what class compromise does. And again, then taking that into the developing world context, capitalist democracies are way weaker as institutions for forging those kinds of social pacts. Other questions on this first opening part? Okay, let's begin. We'll do a few sections of this structural logic, the dilemmas of strategic action, and then we'll take our break. But don't hesitate changing the rules of the game. Still playing the same game, but just change the rules. The game of, you know, professorial lecturing and student listening and questioning. That's our game. But we're changing the rules. Feel free to ask questions as we go. Okay, the structural logic, the dilemmas of strategic action. So here's the big deal idea here. There is a contrast in the logic of collective actions of workers and capitalists. Different groups profoundly face different problems, not the same problem. These differences revolve around two aspects of the problem of collective action. How should we understand the interests of actors? And how do we understand their capacities to act? Interests and capacities. That's the two aspects of the problem. Interests. Capitalists and workers face different problems in knowing or discovering what are their interests. That is, they face different problems of eliminating distortions in their understandings of interests. And here's the basic point around interests. Interests are pretty transparent to capitalists. Their interests are not very hard for them to figure out. The best means to realizing their interests may be hard. You may need a lot of technical knowledge to know what's the best thing to do if you're in the oil sector in 2013 and trying to figure out what's in the interests of the firm. You know, there are issues, but they know what's in their interest, maximizing profits. For workers, interests are much more opaque. The interests that are bound up with their status as workers are way more complicated than the interests of capitalists. And they can't be discovered except through dialogue, especially the notion of the shared interests of workers. So first is this transparency or opacity and complexity of interests. Capacities. Workers and capitalists have different inherent capacities for struggle. In particular, capitalists only have to mobilize financial resources, whereas workers have to mobilize people. This is captured by the contrast between the willingness to pay and the willingness to act. And the willingness to pay is a way simpler way of building collective capacity than the willingness to act. And particularly the willingness to pay of actors who have access to the surplus directly. So the decision to reallocate part of the surplus from direct accumulation to political accumulation, so to speak, by investing in collective capacity, that decision can be made on a kind of pragmatic basis. Which of these allocations is going to stabilize our rate of profit the best, and how to allocate it? Not that there aren't issues, but it's relatively straightforward compared to the question, how do we go about enhancing people's willingness to act? Because the willingness to act requires that your own life be devoted in a different way, which is a bigger demand on people. To explore the implications of this contrast between interests and capacities, Offey and Wiesenthal break the problem down into a number of different steps. In particular, they distinguish between what they call the inputs of associational practices of labor and capital, what has to be organized, the internal processes of associational practices, that's the dynamics within organizations to realize the interests of members, and the outputs. What are the conditions for strategic success of the organization? Inputs, processes, and outputs are the way they break down their argument. I'm going to focus here most on inputs and organizational processes. So first, inputs. What do different associations organize? What do unions organize? What are they actually doing? Well, the first point that they make, which is an interesting one, and one that you might not instantly think about. So it's one of these things which once it's said, it's obvious, but needs to be said. They argue that unions don't simply organize workers. They do that, of course, but that's not really the way to think about it. They organize workers who are already members of capitalist organizations. What they're really doing, in a sense, is reorganizing workers. Workers are already organized in production. They're employees. That's the relation into which they are asserted. And capitalism is already organizing them as members of the labor process within a capitalist firm. They're already organized by capital. What labor unions are doing is reorganizing them along a different basis. They reorganize workers already organized by capital. And that's how to think about what the logic of organization of unions are. And when they do so, they face what Offie and Wiesenthal, I think, very evocatively call the insuperable individuality of workers. When capitalists mobilize resources, the resources stick together. They just become bigger, right? So a capitalist who has a billion-dollar firm and a capitalist who has a $100 million firm, the difference between $100 million and a billion is quantitative, and adding each dollar just makes it bigger. They fuse together into a greater mass of power. Each dollar loses its individuality, so to speak. When you add workers together in an organization, they don't cease to be individual persons. The insuperable individuality of workers means that you cannot merge living labor. It remains intractably discrete. Individual workers own their own individual labor power, but confront an integrated capital. This means that capital can grow in its individual power by capital accumulation. So you can have very powerful individual capitalists because they've accumulated lots of capital. Workers always remain weak as individual labor powers because of this insuperable individuality. The power of workers to confront capital, therefore, depends upon their collective organization. It's only through association that they can achieve any kind of power capable of confronting the power of capitalists. Now, if we lived in a kind of small firm capitalism where the individual capitalists only employed two or three or four workers, and some of those workers had absolutely essential skills for their employer, then it wouldn't be so clear that there was such a big imbalance of power. And particularly if the skills that you learn in the labor process that are specific to your employer are very job specific, so that there's a big loss of revenue if the capitalist fires you, because it takes a long time for somebody to do it well. So you've accumulated skill over time on the job, and there's not very many of you. Well, that would be a case where the power of individual workers wouldn't be so out of whack with the power of individual capitalists. But that's not the kind of capitalism in which we live. This insuperable individuality of workers, I really like that term. You know, there's various little catchphrases you get in a class like this that stick. That's, I think, one of them. The insuperable individuality of workers has pervasive consequences for the interests that working class associations have to pursue and for the power of those organizations. And this leads to these two problems. How do we understand interest aggregation of working class and capitalist class associations? And how do we understand power accumulation? And it's 10 after. I think we should take our break now, and we'll begin with interest aggregation and power accumulation when we come back. So it's five after. Let's try to get back as close to a quarter after as, you know, 6 or 7 minutes, 17 after.
This is more subtle. Should I just hold on?
I guess so.
Did I email yours? Do you want me to bring it?
No, I got them. Yeah. Yeah, I would just hold on to them. It's more likely to get to him for sure if you hold on to it.
This material, I don't know if this is, I'm probably straying, but it seems like that since the primary organization is central, and it has been historically, like the transfer from feudalism to capitalism was a change in the primary organization, but, not the workers. It just doesn't seem, maybe that is what's foolish about it. The workers aren't going to, the secondary organization is not going to displace the primary, and the primary wants to replace the existing primary organization. So a new form of socialist minded, you know what I mean?
So that's the view that
that's the leadership.
In a famous debate between Marx and Trudeau in the 1840s, Trudeau argued that worker owned cooperatives were the way to struggle against capitalism, because he would be replacing capitalist firms with an alternative firm inside of the market. And that worker owned cooperatives could provide a counter economy, not just alternative types of work. And Marx was initially extremely hostile to that. But felt that the capital wouldn't allow it, that the capitalist class would create barriers for the creation of a viable challenging the system of working on firms, and that the only way in which to create the space for a challenging economy of working on firms would be to destroy the power of capitalism. So Marx's view is that working class cannot struggle against capitalism inside of capitalism successfully. The only thing you can do is to create a political by seizing the stage and then destroying the power of capitalism in order to create a space for these alternatives to develop beyond the small niches
and all. Without analysis.
I'm just watching. I'm not sure. I might like saying it differently.
Just tell me what you want me to do. Sorry for being late. You stood in the rain for an hour to bust up.
Yeah.
No, I didn't miss it. The bus schedule said there was supposed to be a bus at like 9:25 or something. I was there at 9:20. I stood in the rain until 10:20.
Was the next one supposed to be 10:20?
10:15, 10:20, yeah. So the next one was late too.
So the first one was early?
No, I don't know what happened. It was either early or it didn't happen and there's a mistake on the schedule or something. But either way, my feet are dry, thank God. But anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, the summary comments are at the end.
Okay.
Okay.